This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yis Wuhib. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight:
access to basic services remain a challenge for Kenya's first growing capital city. And in the informal settlements outside Nairobi, residents are risking their lives for access to cheap, illegal electricity.
That's Raila Ombwara reporting from Nairobi. Details coming up.
Also, U.S. First Lady Michelle Obama flew to Morocco to urge young girls to stay in school and become world leaders. And Somalia welcomes a new U.S. ambassador to the country after 25 years.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Top story this hour: many residents in Nairobi lack access to basic services, especially in those in the informal settlements outside the city. Some are risking their lives accessing cheap but illegal electricity. Raila Ambor has more from Kibera.
Wires sprawl like webs over parts of Kibera. Some of them are repurposed telephone wires balanced on wood and metal poles protruding from rooftops. Live wires are dangerous. Reports of injury and house fires are common. 21-year-old resident Efi Akumu has seen two people killed by electrocution this month. She herself recently made a narrow escape.
Nilikuwa nimeenda kwa land ingine na kulikuwa na earth na nilikuwa na mguu tupu.
I was in one of the neighborhoods here that I was not really familiar with. I had no shoes on and my feet were wet. I saw a flower and I wanted to go get the flower. By bad luck, I stepped on a live wire. I could not move. My sister ran to rescue me. She also got stuck with me. We started pulling ourselves away from the point. We managed to escape, but for some minutes, my brain could not process what was going on. Because electricity theft is illegal, people don't often report such cases to the police. The dangers are well known, but the practice persists. A collection of live wires is strung delicately above George Juma's home. There is no way I can have an electric wire passing through my doorstep, and I do not have electricity. Yet I know if I just connect another wire on the electric wire and cover it up with some soil, I will have electricity. Why can't I do my own connection? Put yourself in my shoes. He says the power supply is tenuous, but he can't afford an electricity bill. The Kenya Power and Lighting Company is taking an interesting approach to tone down cases of theft. Here is Kenya Power Director Ben Chumo.
The solution is not to stop illegal connections. The solution is to offer alternative, cheaper and safe connections to Kibera people. We have given Kibera electricity at the cost of 1,000. And so there is no motivation whatsoever for anybody in Kibera to want to stick an illegal connection, because that illegal connection will be much higher in cost than the former one that we are giving them. And so what we are seeing in Kibera is the slowing down of those illegal connections.
What he is referring to is a program funded along with the World Bank and the Global Partnership on Output-Based Aid, GPOBA, since 2014. For every house that Kenya Power connects in Kibera, the World Bank checks the connection and reimburses the installation cost. The World Bank and Kenya Power also cover the difference between the resident's $10 monthly contribution and what the household actually uses. This project has been rolled out across all informal settlements in Kenya. Kenya Power says so far about 60% of Kibera is legally connected. Residents call it Stimaya tokens, referring to the 1,000 shillings tokens used to pay the monthly bills. You can see the initiative's small portable transformers installed around the area. But some residents say $10 a month is still too expensive. An illegal connection costs as little as $3 US. And for now, the savings outweigh the safety risks. Rael Ombor for VOA News, Nairobi.
The
The Somali ambassador to the U.S. welcomed the naming of the new U.S. ambassador to Somalia after 25 years. Stephen M. Schwartz was sworn in yesterday in Washington. Ambassador Ahmed Issi Awad says it's a new chapter in U.S.-Somali relations.
The significance is obvious and it's historic and it's a very important one. The ambassador, U.S. ambassador, to go back to Somalia after more than two decades of the absence of U.S. ambassador in Somalia. It's significant in the sense that it will strengthen already good relationship between the United States and Somalia and between the two peoples. It will deepen the cooperation, whether it is economic, educational, diplomatic, security. You know, the Americans are helping Somalia, have been helping over the years in fighting extremism, violent extremism. They have been helping us in reestablishing our state institutions. So that will become, that effort, that relationship and cooperation will become further expanded. As the Deputy Secretary mentioned in his statement, it is to further expand the relationship on security, economic development, and strengthening good governance in Somalia.
Schwartz is a career U.S. Foreign Service officer. He recently served as director for the Office of Australia, New Zealand, and Pacific Island Affairs, and has served in Mauritius, South Africa, Cuba, Kenya, and other diplomatic posts. In his swearing-in ceremony, Schwartz said it's time for Somali authorities to establish a responsive and effective Somali National Army to defeat al-Shabaab and unify the country. Ambassador Awad told the VOA Somali service that Schwartz will likely be heading to the region next month. He will probably start in Nairobi, where he will begin the process of moving the U.S. Embassy to Mogadishu.
First Lady Michelle Obama was greeted on her arrival in Morocco this morning by Princess Lala Salma. Obama is on the second of a six-day tour in Africa and Europe, promoting leadership training for young girls around the world. She is speaking out against forced marriage, poverty, and the violence that keeps more than 62 million girls globally out of school. UNICEF figures show the literacy rate among young Moroccan women is 74%, compared to 88% for young men. Mrs. Obama was accompanied by her two daughters, Sasha and Malia, and by actresses Meryl Streep and Frida Pinto. The U.S. Embassy in Rabat says the group will address obstacles to full education for Moroccan girls. Mrs. Obama met yesterday with Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf and spoke at several Liberian school events to young girls, urging them to stay in school to become world leaders.
In Liberia, there's a debate over how to ensure free and transparent elections next year. The Electoral Commission wants to introduce the biometric system for the polls, but the president says the government does not have the funds. Others say without the system, the polls could be rigged. Jerome Korkoya is the chairman of the National Elections Commission of Liberia. Reporter James Butty asked him for his view of the situation.
The biometric system is very effective. This is not to say that it doesn't have its own problems. It does have some problems. But it is a very concrete step towards modernizing any electoral process. So the decision of the board was to have it introduced in Liberia for the first time, given the critical nature of the 2017 elections. So in our regard, we did some work, we did some consultations with other sister electoral organizations around the world. But unfortunately, the government does not have the funding for us to carry this through. So what we will be doing, will be reverting to the OMR, that is the old system that we have used in Liberia.
So did you say that the government does not have the funding?
We have been informed that the government cannot fund it at this point. Apparently, there is no partner coming with means to support it, and we cannot fund ourselves. As you know, we don't generate funding, so we have to depend on it.
What currently is your budget compared to previous say, let's say the 2011 compared 2011. Yeah.
2011, my understanding is that the records I have available to me shows there was something as a minimum of $50 million. And I remember, James, that was the time when O'Neill and other partners were providing substantial assistance for the electoral process. For example, transportation, most part of Liberia, were difficult to get the electoral materials. O'Neill was always there to use helicopter services and things like those. Now that they are gone, and at that time, my understanding, of course, was is that there were no attempt to use the biometric at the time. We're using the OMR with the assistance of O'Neill. The budget at the time was a minimum of $50 million. Our budget that we submitted was something like $49 million. So that's about $1 million less. And that was going to include biometric and take a place of what O'Neill were providing. And we thought that was a reasonable budget. But unfortunately, the government just doesn't have the money.
So let me put it this way. Are you getting the support of the government in terms of preparation for the election?
Yeah, we will. Let me put it this way. Government is a major sponsor we have. Without their support, we're not going to do the elections. So we expect that they will be providing the necessary support. Up to this point, we are putting all the pre-electoral activities that we need money for and then submit that to the president's office for her consideration. So we hope that the government will be forthcoming.
Mr. Chairman, the people say that some people say maybe they're concerned about the number of political parties in the elect process. What are you doing? Do you feel you need to come down to say perhaps we need to cut down the number of political parties, or do you feel it's okay for anyone who wants to be president to register?
No, it is not what I feel personally. It is what the law requires. If there is any organization in the world whose activities is conditioned by the law, that is the electoral management body. So everything we do here is restricted and regulated and conditioned by the law. Our constitution made it a little liberal for political parties, organization, and formation. I think, judging from past experience, the people who drafted the constitution thought that it would be a good thing to do so. But some people argue that they've been abused. So it is not easy for us to stop people from organizing political parties insofar as they meet the requirement laid down by the Constitution and our guidelines. That is why we're responsible for the multiplicity of political parties in Liberia.
What's the next major step coming up for in your timetable?
The next major step will be voter registration. That is very crucial. Of course, the Constitution requires that. The quality of the election anywhere in the world depends on the voter roll. So, you know, we did it, and this is one of the advantages that of the biometric, how we use it, that we will not have to repeat registration all the time that we have elections. But the Constitution mandatorily requires that we do elections for people who turn 18, some Liberians who are not being in the country, and so on and so forth. So we do that for every electoral period. So that's the next major electoral event that we'll be having.
That was Jerome Korkoya, the chairman of Liberia's National Elections Commission. He was talking with reporter James Buddy.
Hour. This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America. The world's last supply of a particular type of African anti-venom will expire by the end of June. The unique anti-venom treats bites from many different types of African snakes and has saved thousands of lives every year. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg that the Fav Afrique's demise is a complicated one that reflects a deeper crisis brewing in global public health.
Fav Afrique, a particularly effective African antivenom, will be completely unavailable because its manufacturer, French pharmaceutical company Sanofi Pasteur, decided it was not profitable. This has prompted aid groups like Doctors Without Borders to sound the alarm over the imminent shortage of Fav Afrique, which simultaneously treats bites from 10 types of snakes. The aid group estimates that 30,000 Africans die of snake bites each year. Here's Dr. Monica Rule, a health advisor for Doctors Without Borders, which is known by MSF, its French acronym.
We are upset about the decision of Sanofi Pasteur to stop Fav Afrique because we need the antivenom, and I don't mention only MSF, it's all health providers in remote zones of Africa. We need an antivenom that it's polyvalent and it's easy to use, not thinking too much about which is the type of snake that has bitten the patient.
There are, she said, other antivenoms available in Africa, but none is as effective as Fava Freak, and few are polyvalent, meaning they can treat multiple poisons. Patients often can't accurately identify the species of snake that attacked them. The pharmaceutical company says governments and donors are equally responsible for this situation. Dr. Jean Long was part of the team that developed Fava Freak 2 decades ago. Speaking to VOA from Sanofi Pasteur's facility in Lyon, France, Long says while tests have shown that Fava Freak is very effective, his product has disadvantages at the market. Production is lengthy and complicated, and it will take at least 2 years to make a batch to replace the one now expiring. Fava Freak has to be refrigerated, a challenge for rural African clinics, and treatment is expensive, with the average patient needing multiple courses that total about $500.
We are facing a situation when the people who decide at the Ministry of Health of these African countries, of course, considering the price of the product, and all these characteristics about efficacy and safety are not yet at the final decisions when you face a fivefold cheaper product and you consider that they are equivalent because you are not a scientist or a physician.
When the company decided in 2010 to discontinue Fava Freak, it announced that it would share the technology with anyone who wanted to resume production. No one has stepped up, Lang says. Long says he is worried that the death of Fava Freak is a symptom of a bigger problem in the healthcare industry. He says his company is urging donors, governments, and aid organizations to step up to fund essential pharmaceuticals like vaccines and antivenoms. As the boardroom battle rages over who will pay for these life-saving medications, the burden is now falling to those who can least afford it. Patients, who may pay with their lives. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Every year, the police arrest thousands of people in South Africa for allegedly driving under the influence of alcohol. But according to research by the Justice Project, an NGO monitoring the implementation of the country's laws, only 6% of suspects are ever convicted of the crime. According to the government, alcohol is a factor in almost 60% of all road crash fatalities in South Africa. In the last part of our cities and the chaos on the country's roads, Darren Taylor takes us into the mind of a man who regularly drives drunk.
Surging down Johannesburg's M1 highway in an SUV, serenaded by American metal band Rage Against the Machine. It's just past 10 on a Friday night. The highway is electric with light and noise from speeding cars. Businessman Robert van Rensburg, not his real name, is at the wheel, with the alcohol from 5 beers and 3 tequilas pulsing through his veins. He's well over the legal limit to drive, so van Rensburg is committing a crime. Not that he's worried.
You always get away with that. If a police van or even a Metro Police car stops you, you know, you can either talk your way out of it or you can bribe your way out of it.
Van Rensburg tells how police recently stopped him at a roadblock after he'd consumed quite a few beers. He says he told a police officer he didn't want to blow into the breathalyzer because he didn't trust the device to measure his alcohol level correctly.
Then he said, okay, but if you don't want to take the test, then how are we going to do this? And then you just say, here's my license, and with a license you give him a few hundred rand.
After paying the bribe, says van Rensburg, the policeman waved him on, and he continued driving to another party. So, on to the next party it is, a bar filled with raucous men celebrating a bachelor's party, drinking shooter after shooter. The inebriated groom-to-be is nearly naked, clothed only in a rainbow-striped Mexican sombrero and a nappy. Van Rensburg smiles at the scene and says he drives under the influence of liquor all the time.
Basically, it's all a blank. Whatever you do, the way you drive, you don't remember much.
He says it's often his unlucky passengers who inform him of his recklessness.
They come the next day and they say, the way you were driving last night, it was crazy. No, you skipped robots, you went over these humps and this and that.
Van Rensburg recalls being involved in several collisions. One night after a drinking session, he says he collapsed into bed next to his wife.
She woke me up. She said, now, what's all this blood on you? I was like, blood, what? I don't know. And I carried on sleeping.
The next morning, he awoke to find his car smashed in his garage. He'd obviously injured himself by crashing his vehicle while on the way home.
Drive 450 meters, then exit left.
Van Rensburg's GPS guides him to another destination. He acknowledges it's a miracle that he's never collided with another car.
I wrote off a BMW once. I went over a pavement, a T-junction. I think, again, can't remember, think I was busy on my cell phone.
But you had been drinking also that night?
Yes, I had a bottle of brandy at home.
He says he abandoned the wreck and began to walk home, only to be confronted by the police. He denied being the driver of the vehicle.
And then eventually they even took me home.
Van Rensburg says following the incident, he never heard from the police again. Back at the bar, Van Rensburg emphasizes that another reason he and others drink and drive is South Africa's poor public transport system. There are no late-night buses or trains. There are, however, plenty of private taxis for hire. But Van Rensburg says they're too expensive for most people. And even if they were cheap, taking a taxi isn't practical in South Africa.
You can take a taxi home, but what about your vehicle? With the crime in South Africa, you can't leave your car in the middle of nowhere. The next day you come there, your car will be gone.
He says he does sometimes worry that he'll injure or even kill others or himself when driving under the influence. But when he starts drinking, these concerns fade fast.
You take that risk. You don't even see it as a risk. You just think, okay, I have to get home now. It's not even a consideration.
Robert Van Rensburg is just one of millions of South Africans who think nothing of drinking and driving. They're out on the roads day and night, a grave danger to themselves and others, primed to become part of an estimated 20 to 25,000 people killed on the country's roads every year. I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in Johannesburg.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiswu Hebe in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC.
For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, John Dryden, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Linor Mudu. Please join me live every Tuesday at 17:30 UTC in VOA's health program, Health Chat. Hear from doctors, nurses, international experts discussing the health issues of your concern. Health Chat puts listeners directly in touch with medical professionals. You can talk to them live for free or email your questions. Health Chat brings the medical professionals to your home.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, we'll discuss the 18-year-old prison sentence given to former Congolese Vice President Jean-Pierre Bemba by the International Criminal Court for rape and murder in the Central African Republic. Tune in to Straight Talk Africa, next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
The Voice of America, VOA.